G'day, I'm Alan Kohler, Editor-in-Chief of Eureka Report. Welcome to The Money Cafe. Joining me today is Sally McManus, Secretary of the Australian Council of Trade Unions. Welcome to The Money Cafe, Sally.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. It's great to be here.
Well, unfortunately, we can't meet in the cafe, of course, because we're locked down for another week. We hope it's only another week, but...
I've still got a coffee.
Good. So have I. So we're in our separate cafes. Are you in the office or at home?
In the office.
Yes, right. Very good. I've got so much to ask you about, and I just was very interested in the fact that you did philosophy at Macquarie University, and I'd be interested to know what you studied. Did you study the Enlightenment philosophers, and any in particular?
Well, a broad range, because it was epistemology, which is basically the theory of knowledge, and so that goes from Socrates to Hegel to Hathaway. So across all sort of thought, modern and ancient, really. But there was a particular sort of branch of that, I guess, which was the new area of AI, so artificial intelligence and cognitive science and the theory of thought. So, put simply, can machines can they learn in the way humans do, and what makes us different in terms of how we learn and how the brain works, and will it be possible for us to make machines that do the same? So more in the theory of that rather than obviously the actual mechanics of it. I wasn't building robots, put it that way.
No, but how much AI and so on was going on when you were at uni?
Yeah, so this was more early days, like obviously technology, what was it like sort of 27 years ago, which was when I was at uni. Well, it was the days before before smartphones, that's for sure, well before then. But I guess I was always an early adopter of technology anyway and interested in it. And, we had, people's imagination goes before inventions. So obviously there was a whole lot of movies with cyborgs and things like that. So this idea of, blending flesh and blood with machines was something that was talked about a lot then, like it is now. Now obviously we talk about, are the machines taking away jobs, as well as a whole lot of other issues.
Are they?
This is a bit contested area. So it's been predicted for quite a while that, technology will mean the end of work, but we're not seeing the end of work. We're seeing higher participation rates than ever. And, there's the other theory, which seems to be bearing out in practice, that actually it creates more jobs. If you think about it in a simple way, you think about a university, let's say, and that they've moved a whole lot of stuff online, they've changed the way things happen. But out of all of that, a whole lot of, new and different jobs are created in terms of, all the IT professionals and software engineers and all of that behind. So I don't think we've yet seen the evidence of jobs being replaced, because there's a human capacity to have more and different needs as things change as well.
Does that accord with the theories that you came up with,
So we sort of studied the way that we build machines is in a linear way, so it's sort of which is very different to the way the brain works, which is a connected way. So what will happen is, you might think of a dog, for example, and in your brain sort of neurons will connect and synapses will sort of spark and in a patterned way of associations. And so, the pattern in your brain when you think of a dog might be different to mine, and it also might be different. Let's say you got bitten by a dog when you were young. You might have different associations to someone who's, always had, pet dogs and loves them. So that's the way we've gone about building machines is very different to actually how thought works and memories work in terms of human beings, so, and how knowledge gets learnt. So that's a particular challenge, I guess, for those who would like to, develop machines that are capable of self-consciousness.
Hmm. Well, we could talk about that all day, but the other thing I'm interested in about you is that you have a black belt in Kung Fu and Taekwondo, and you're a boxer. So I presume this is why, this is how you became Secretary of the ACTU.
Well, I always want to call us union thugs, don't they? Well, what, some of the important things about martial arts is like never, ever using it unless in self-defense or defending others. So I think that's probably more in line with what unions do. But, yeah, look, I've always been, I guess, a sporty person ever since I was young, have loved it and have not been bad at it. And I got into martial arts when I was probably, I don't know, 20, maybe even 19. And, yes, I studied one, the Korean one, and then the Chinese one later.
The Korean one being Taekwondo.
Taekwondo, that's right, and then Kung Fu being the Chinese one. And I'm doing boxing now, to be honest, simply because I actually 3 years ago thought, well, because there's a humility about going back to the beginning, like turning up with, you know, with a white belt or the metaphorical equivalent and with no knowledge and starting from the beginning, which is what I did when I started Kung Fu. And so I thought, oh, well, I'm now living in Melbourne. I'll try something new. I thought, what about jiu-jitsu? So I went to the local jiu-jitsu place, but look, very quickly learnt that probably wasn't the type of martial arts for someone, you know, nearing 50. And especially full stop. So my brain was telling me to do certain things, but unfortunately my body wasn't reacting how I would like it to, and I was spending a lot of time being beaten up by 17-year-olds. So I thought, okay, let's just accept all of this, and at least with boxing, all the creaky joints I've got in my legs probably from lots of Taekwondo over the years aren't put under stress.
So what's the difference between the Korean one and the Chinese one?
Well, key difference is like whether you're facing your opponent. So in Taekwondo, and for those who might have watched part of the Olympics, it's in there, but that's sort of sports Taekwondo, which, you know, some of us would really look down on. But you stand.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Then to the side, and you would, there's a lot of kicking, and it's above the waist. Whereas Kung Fu, you're facing straight on, and much less kicking. But yeah, you know,
I presume you have to make little noises like Bruce Lee, do you?
I've noticed when I was watching actually the Olympics and the karate, there was lots of that. And yes, I guess we did, but after a while, you just sort of forget about that; it just becomes part of it.
Yeah, right. So let's just talk about the ACTU and your career there, because interestingly, obviously, you're the first female secretary, but there have been a succession of female presidents, starting with Jenny George in 1996. You became secretary 4 years ago. So why did it take so much longer for there to be a female secretary than a president?
Well, ACTU is 92 years old. So, yeah, we were formed in 1929. And for a long part of that history, the workforce and the unionised workforce, but also the workforce, was, of course, male-dominated. And, you know, as we all know, that changed a lot, especially, you know, after World War II. And then after the 1970s, and a whole lot of laws changed around, you know, what married women could do as well. And so, and also the structure of our workforce has changed. So there's been a big shift towards service economy, obviously, and the strongest unionised parts of our movement are, or the economy, are healthcare and education, and they're feminised industries. But all of that sort of didn't happen overnight, and there was definitely a lag in terms of reflecting the gender makeup of union membership and the leadership. And perhaps there was an issue, I think, in terms of secretary, about maybe unconscious sexism about this, thinking that, well, only the blokes can do, you know, the things to do with finances. And
well, that's what I was wondering, you know, was the thinking that only blokes can run the joint. I mean, I suppose I don't really understand the difference between president and secretary, because they're both full-time jobs, aren't they?
Yeah, so one's the effectively the CEO, and, you know, the other runs all the meetings, and also does the a lot of the public spokesperson stuff along with me too. And, you know, obviously we share things as well. So it's not sort of like a straight down the line thing. It is in terms of the sort of operational side. The secretary does that. So perhaps that was the case. Not now. Half my executive is women, and that's because of an affirmative action rule that's been there now for 20 years. And so that means that probably unlike most boardrooms and certainly political parties, there's been 50-50 decision-making at the highest level since the mid-90s.
Does that make a big difference to the way decisions are made, do you think?
Yeah, it really does. Like I've over the time I've been a union leader, so I was the leader of my union prior to coming here. I sat around a lot of tables where I was it was either me or one other person, one other woman, sorry. And so I think the sort of general culture and tone of a meeting is different, and I've seen that also change in lots of forums that I've been in, like where you get more of a equal balance. Also, obviously, you just get a better perspective on the world. But also, you know, sometimes I've been in meetings, and these aren't necessarily union ones, but, you know, with employers and others where they forget there's a woman in the room. And I find that quite interesting, because just the sort of banter that goes on, not necessarily sexist, is not the same banter that happens when there's mixed company.
Yeah, I can absolutely imagine. I mean, I grew up with Albert Monk and Harold Suter.
Oh, yeah.
Albert Monk being the president, Harold Suter being the secretary, and then Bob Hawke. I mean, but as president, Bob Hawke absolutely ran the place.
Yeah, look.
It's kind of difference. And then when Bill Keldy was secretary, he ran the place.
I think it's a fair bit to do with personalities as well, and at particular periods of time. So, yeah, it's no getting around that either.
I mean, what about the connection between the ACTU and the Labor Party, which obviously in the days of Keldy and Hawke running, being Prime Minister and Keating as Treasurer, the connection between the two was enormously strong. But it doesn't seem to be that way anymore. Is that a reasonable observation?
I think there's two things. Firstly, obvious that Labor's not in government, and so the type of interaction wouldn't be the same. And if I talk to my predecessors, and they make that point very strongly, that there's a huge difference there. Secondly, going to that issue of the makeup of unions. So I mentioned that both the nurses' union and the teachers' unions are now are our biggest unions. Those unions aren't affiliated to the Labor Party. So, more than half of the affiliates, the ACTU, are not affiliated to the Labor Party.
So, what difference does that make?
Well, there's not like the institutional connections back, it's not like it would be within a union that's affiliated. You know, you've then got, you know, other decision making, forums that you're part of as an affiliated union to the Labor Party, and that you're thinking about those interests too, whereas at the ACTU it's not like that, and consciously absolutely not like that, because, you know, more than half our affiliates aren't ALP affiliates.
But on the first point, I mean, even when the Labor Party was in power between 2007 and 2013, and Jeff Lawrence was the secretary of the ACTU, and who was president?
Sharon Burrow.
Yeah, that's right. So there didn't seem to be much going on between the ACTU and the Labor Party then.
And Jed was there for most of that time too. Well, there was the Fair Work Act, so that was a pretty major thing. That was replacing the Work Choices legislation. That was a major project, which, you know, there was obviously close work that happened between the two there. So that was project. There was the issue of also paid parental leave. That was a big thing that happened with the ACTU and the ALP as well.
But obviously there's also the declining membership of unions. Now I'm looking at the ABS data from last December on union membership, down from 45.6% of the total workforce in 86 to 14.3 last year, and it continues to fall. I mean, it fell again last year, 14.3% of the workforce. I mean, are we heading for a situation where you just disappear?
I don't think so. In fact, I'd be happy to bet whatever you wanted on it. I don't think it would be possible. Wherever, you know, there is, you know, employers, there will be always a need for unions. What's happened is major changes happened to our laws. This started really with John Howard, where you'll remember that awards, which are basically, let's call them contracts across an industry where employers need to follow, they used to have provisions in there that encourage union membership. For example, if you're a union member, you got preference in promotions and things like that. So that meant that there was a built-in incentive for people to be union members. One of the first things John Howard did, of course, was change that in awards. So that came out. If you talk to, grandparents, my grandparents, and who unfortunately aren't with us, but one's grandparents, and ask them, like, why did they join a union, or even a group of people, 20 years older than me, like, why did you join a union when you started work? Nearly all of them will say because it was part of the job, and that was in law, but also part of the culture, and that really broke with sort of the advent of neoliberalism in a way, and those legal changes. Alongside that, some other big changes happened. So shift in our economy away from really large workplaces in the manufacturing area, obviously, to more service-based economy, and traditionally, never unionised, and also a big growth in job insecurity. And so I think that those things have made a big difference. That's not to say that unions shouldn't have, do things that beyond addressing some of those issues. Some of them you'd want to address, and some of them, that you're not going to address. Like, for example, the change in the makeup of the economy. Although, of course, we think that you should be, we should have a manufacturing industry. It's important to be building things in Australia, but not linked to union membership.
Is there a point below which, you start to become too irrelevant? I mean, is it like, and what's the point, 10% or 5%? At what point?
Well, part of the issue when you talk about relevancy is, and it goes to the issue, like, we have a situation in Australia, unlike most other countries, where you get the benefits for being in a union when you're not a member. So, for example, when enterprise bargaining happens, non-members get the pay rises. Like, there's no differentiation. Whereas in a lot of other countries, what will happen is workers will vote whether they want to be in a union, then everyone's in. Or if there's an agreement at a workplace, there is, union fees automatically paid on that basis. We don't have that situation. So if you talk about relevance, it's about 60% of the workforce whose wages and conditions are set by, influenced by, or, directly by unions. So that's all the awards. So every year there's the minimum wage case, which unions run, and then there's bargaining, and that is almost exclusively unions that do that. So there's a whole lot of workers that every day benefit from unions, but they don't need to join.
But there must come a point at which you're not getting enough revenue from membership fees. To do your job, to have enough people, to employ enough people, and to do the representation you need to do.
I suppose that in theory that would be an issue. I think we're not nearly at that point. I think that unions were clearly one way that this has been dealt with over a period of time is through amalgamations. So there's
getting
a whole
costs
lot,
down.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of really small unions that used to exist that no longer do because they're part of bigger organisations and sharing at that sort of cost base that you need to do in order to run an organisation.
And I just wonder what proportion of the union membership now is female.
Well, you've got those ABS statistics in front of you. What do they say? Does it say 54?
Where is it?
It's
given me numbers rather than percentage. Oh, there it is. Women, 55%.
There you go, 55%. So,
and what did it used to be when you joined the ACTU?
Well, I think that when I joined, it had just tipped over to women being the majority. And when I say just tipped over, I think it was like, it was a big thing. Like for us, it was like, 50.7 or whatever it was. So you can see even in a short period of time, that's changed a lot. And that is partly to do with what we were talking about before, changes in the economy and those occupations and industries that are more unionized or feminized industries.
Yeah, that's right. So that explains why the leadership is female now too.
Yeah, of course. So usually, obviously, there's a lag with these things too. Goes back to you know, those changes. So either you bring in sort of, you know, rules that affirmative action rules really to deal with that, or you have to wait a long period of time for it to change. And as we can see, you know, in some organisations, it never does.
So just before we close, what are the big challenges or the campaigns you've got coming up? I noticed there was a court case the other day in the High Court about casualisation. Can you explain what that is and what you're going to do about that?
Yeah, so the issue of the number of insecure jobs, or put it another way, the lack of secure jobs in our country, we think is is the number one issue that's got to be tackled. That decision by the High Court basically, well,
what was it called?
Rosato. So that was the name of the fellow who took the case. So it was him versus a company called WorkPac, which is a labour hire company in the mining industry. And what was happening is the labour hire company was hiring all these workers who worked a regular roster. Not only that, most of them got the roster, some of them a year in advance. Like, here's your shifts. Who gets in a year in advance? So you can't have any more idea of like ongoing permanent work than that. And the labour hire company was calling them casual. They were also paid $35 an hour less than permanent employees. So it's basically a mechanism in order to cut wages, really. So it was a case, to say, it was on appeal, obviously, because that's why it was at the High Court. The High Court found that what mattered was the contract. So like the letter, the contract of employment that the worker had, whether or not it said that they were a casual. And that's all that mattered, not the fact that this person in every other way, like in their actual day-to-day work, was working regular permanent hours. So obviously this is a big problem for us as a country, because if individual employers get to deem someone a casual or not, regardless of whether it's a permanent job, why would not, if you were a bad employer, just say, well, we're no longer hiring permanents, every single person will be a casual.
That seems to be at odds with another case that I saw concerning the Qantas contractors, where I think it was a court case. Was it the High Court?
The High Court, although Qantas wants to take it there.
The court decided, I think it was the federal court then, must have decided that the contractors are actually employees. I mean, that seems to be kind of conflicting with the Rosati case.
I don't think that's if it's the one I think you're talking about, the recent one, it wasn't that. It was that the court found it was unlawful for Qantas to outsource their ground handling, their baggage handlers basically, because they did so in part to get around some of the things the union was
doing. Oh, I see.
Yeah, so not quite the same. But back to the issue of secure jobs, there's a whole lot that governments can do to give workers greater job security, which partly also goes to the rights that they have, like sick leave, annual leave, all those basic things. And if they don't do that, we will end up in a situation where we'll see those rights, which were won by generations of workers, disappear. Not only that, the impact on individuals and families of job insecurity is a negative one. And I'd argue too, it's negative on communities and the economy. Like, if people don't have certainty about their income, they're not going to be certain about their spending either.
So, but you presumably want legislation now, but you're not going to get that unless there's a Labor government, are you?
Well, I mean, we'll keep arguing, but we saw that the Morrison government isn't likely to cross those big labor hire companies or other business interests, I guess, and act to fix this. I don't really have any faith they will. So that's true. There would need to be a change of government in order for this to be fixed.
Yeah. Well, Sally, it's time for us to move on to questions, and you may be excused if you wish, because all the questions are to do with investment and probably not your cup of tea.
No worries. Good to have a chat.
Okay, so now let's move on to some questions which we have here, and it's just me now. No, Sally's taken off because they're not questions about working people and unions. But the first question is from Ian. And there's a couple of questions about Afterpay and Square, which we'll do together. After Ian says, I'm an Afterpay shareholder after buying the dip in March 2020. Well done, Ian. You're a smart fellow, that you've done well there. Given the recent takeover announcement by Square, can you please discuss the pros and cons of taking up either shares of Square on the NYSE or taking up the newly listed CDIs on the ASX? Hamish says, we all know what Square does. What are your and your guests' thoughts? I'm afraid Sally doesn't have any thoughts on Square, but on Square as a company. What are your thoughts on its future growth opportunities and its place amongst competition? How much of their business is dependent on the success of Bitcoin? Do you think the joining of it and Afterpay speeds up the rate of growth, considering the supposed crossover of customers, et cetera? Okay, well, the first question on the question of whether you should own Square on the NYSE or CDIs on the ASX, that really has to do with whether you want to take a currency risk or not. I mean, you can't avoid a currency risk to some extent because you're owning a foreign US company, but if you buy them on the ASX, obviously you can use Australian dollars. That's about it. I mean, they're basically shares in Square. If you want to buy them on the NYSE, you have to buy US dollars first, and you're holding them in US dollars. So what happens to the currency will impact your investment. The second question of whether you should own shares in Square or not is another question. And the truth is that it is, at this point, basically a Bitcoin trader mainly. 60% or 70% of his revenue came from trading Bitcoin. And so I think the longer-term plan is to get away from that and to become a payments business entirely. But for the moment, that's what it is. And, well, that's been pretty good so far. But that's not what you're doing when you're buying Afterpay shares. You're buying something that you believe is the future of payments and finance. So as for Square's future in that, well, look, I do think the banking system is being disrupted by quite a lot of fintechs coming in various ways, and Square's payments business looks to be quite disruptive. It's still very small. It's got a long way to go. But I do think that, you know, it's one way to join it, and I think that putting Square and Afterpay together is not a bad idea. So, look, I think there'd probably be worse investments than Square, but, you wouldn't want to put too much of your house on it, I would think. John says, during lockdown, I was sharing the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie with my son last week, a cross-generational moment. Good for you, John. And I suddenly thought, the ultimate question is, where does all the money go? I mean, the billions of dollars of profit earned by our banks, miners, tech companies, etc., earned every year. Yes, I know. I assume it's invested and whizzing around the global economy, but then why is the share of global income so disproportionate among the rich and the poor? And this situation apparently increasing. Is it all really just sitting in corporate balance sheets and nations' balance of trade? Or perhaps is this really the true basis of MMT? Look, it's a bit of a deep question, John, but the money, some of it's retained by the company, some of it's distributed. Australian companies distribute more of their money to shareholders than American companies. It's an average of about 75% of profits in Australia get distributed to shareholders in the form of dividends. In America, it's much less. I think it's less than 50%. They retain the money. Often they buy back their own shares to enhance the share price. And that then leads to and has led to an enormously disproportionate gain for the rich than the poor. Because if the share price of a company or the market value of a company goes up, say it doubles from, I don't know, pick a number, $1 million to $2 million, and say 30% of the company is owned by one individual and the rest of it's owned by super funds and very dispersed people, that individual has seen their wealth double. And so they have got an enormous benefit from the increase in the value of that company, whereas all the various individuals dispersed, the millions and thousands of people who are small shareholders through their super funds generally, have had only a very small increase in their wealth because that company represents a very tiny proportion of their super fund. And so a big part of the reason there's been such a disproportionate distribution of what's going on is because of the increase in the share, the value of companies, means that the individuals, the rich people who own big parts of those companies, disproportionately benefit. Tom of Tasmania says, on the future of green hydrogen gas and its useful transporter cousin green ammonia, the global plan is to get the price down. As an investment, not personal advice, of course, e.g. Fortescue Future Industries, what considerations apply when the end product is aiming at a low price, $2 per kilogram? Should we just hope that it becomes ubiquitous and gets returns from enormous volumes, essentially part of clean energy manufacturing future? Tom, I read something the other day that in order for hydrogen to be viable, the price of carbon needs to be $100. Now, it's close to $100 in Europe at the moment, 58 euros, which is $91 Australian, a bit less in US dollars. It's not so much, it isn't just the price of hydrogen that has to come down, but the price of carbon has to go up. And I do think that that's probably going to happen. So I think there is a viable industry in hydrogen at some point, possibly not tomorrow, but there will be a lot of money put into, I know there's a lot of money going into getting the price of hydrogen, the cost of hydrogen down, but also the competing cost of fossil fuels will rise as a result of net zero emissions by 2050, which will have to be accompanied by quite tight emissions trading schemes like Europe's. So I think in a couple of years' time, there'll be a global emissions trading scheme system, which will see the price of carbon credits, wherever they're traded, go above $100 a tonne. And that's going to put the cost of fossil fuels up enormously. But it'll mean that alternative fuels such as renewable energy and hydrogen will be much more viable. Ian says, Mr. Barefoot Investor says to pay down your HECS debt fast, as it's the lowest interest rate. I presume we mean the highest interest rate. If the CPI is 3.8% and my mortgage is 1.79%, then it would seem Mr. Pape is off the mark by a factor of 50%. I think he means that you're paying a high interest rate on your HECS debt, so you've got to get it down so that you're left with a mortgage. The Wright family says, do you feel that the BNPL, buy now, pay later, is an emerging regulatory basket case waiting to happen as increasing defaults or partial defaults start to increase? What might be the impact to current products if regulation changes were imposed? Look, I do think that in time it'll be more regulated. I think they need to figure out, the regulators and the industry really need to figure out whether they're a lending business or a payments business. They're a combination of the two. I get that. People are using Afterpay and other buy now, pay later to actually just pay and are not particularly interested necessarily in borrowing money for a month or 6 weeks or whatever it is. But I do think the lending part of it is going to be regulated. I think that is going to be a bit of a headwind for them as to whether it becomes a basket case waiting to happen. For that reason, I'm not sure. But I do think that a lot of the, my view is that a lot of the blue sky projections for BNPL are overdone. I just don't think it's going to get anything like the penetration that a lot of investors think. That's just me. Pity says, I'm in the same boat as many at the moment, trying to buy into the property market for the first time with interest rates so low and such minimal LVR requirements. I feel there are a lot of people who are just scraping through in terms of affordability. And when we inevitably see the interest rates rise, many people will be pushed over the edge. Maybe a good idea would be to have the requirement that first home buyers or those with LVRs over 80% have to pay an extra 0.5 to 1% on top of the current interest rates, but this extra payment goes into an offset type account that can be drawn down once interest rates rise. This would ensure everyone can afford the extra payments and could steer us away from a nasty crash and could also help but put a dampener on the unsustainable increased growth that we're seeing at the moment. Pity, I think you're onto something there. It's something I advise my children to do where possible, and that is to particularly where they get a lower interest rate, if they manage to, as interest rates have come down, and they should keep repayments where they were and, as you say, pay the extra either into off the mortgage or into an offset account, same thing really. So, yeah, I mean, so I think should happen. As to making it mandatory, I don't think anyone's going to ever do that, but I do think it's something that people should do if they can. That's for sure, so that they can create a buffer for themselves for when interest rates do go up. Matt says, I bought my first house almost exactly a year ago, and since then I'd conservatively estimate an increase in the value of $120,000, could be as high as $170,000, going by sales in the area. I'm going over my options about how best to take advantage of this, as I'm keen to push for as much wealth creation as possible. Totally understand you can't provide personal advice. Correct. But I'd be keen to hear your thoughts on using equity to kickstart a portfolio. Background info that may influence this is that I'm 26, no dependents, and have 500 cash flow a month that I can spare without stressing. So I can't give personal advice. You've given me far too much information, Matt. So anything I say is likely to be taken as personal advice. But in general, the idea of using your room on the mortgage to invest in equities is okay. It's certainly better than using a margin loan, because margin loans are more expensive and you are subject to margin calls. When the price of the thing that you've bought goes down, you have to top it up with cash. So if you're using equity in your house, room and so on, and the mortgage to do it, then that you don't have those things. But just bear in mind, you are borrowing, so you're increasing the risk. You know, the problem is the shares are much more volatile than housing. So, but look, you know, the volatility is a problem with margin calls and margin loans, because, you know, that's where you get into trouble having to meet margin calls. But if you're not subject to that, then you're making a long-term investment. Then what you've got to make sure of is that your return is greater than the interest rate you're paying on the mortgage. And that's not too hard on the whole, because, mortgage rates are low. There's no reason why you shouldn't be able to fund the interest with dividends from the stocks that you buy after tax. You've got to make sure you take tax into account. So you probably need a dividend yield of 5% to pay a mortgage of 2 to 2.5%. So the investment could fund itself, and then you're getting the ride, in a sense, not for free, but you're focusing on capital gain, and over a long time, share prices do tend to go up. So look, as a general advice thing, I think that that's not a bad strategy. And that's the last question. Thanks very much for that, and thanks very much to Sally McManus for joining us in the Money Cafe, which I thought was tremendously interesting. Thanks for paying attention, and thanks for your company. I'll be on leave for the next few weeks. I'm getting a knee replacement. But next week, Steve Sammartino, our technology commentator, is going to take charge, and he's going to be joined by Steve Vallis, the CEO of Blockchain Australia, for a chat about crypto and blockchain. So that should be fantastic, really interesting, because both of those two Steves are extremely knowledgeable on the subject. So tune in for that and send in your questions about crypto and blockchain. And Steve and Steve will be delighted to answer them. Send the questions into themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. So until next time, from me, I'm Alan Kohler, Editor-in-Chief at Eureka Report.